Hello and good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Out Front. I'm your host, Mike Shelby. By the way, Pat, do you live in Georgia by any chance? I used to know a Pat. It might have been you. I think I may have even stayed at your house one time. He says, preparedness among my coworkers has exploded. I spend more time conducting classes than quote unquote working. All right. Well, I don't know if I'm your boss, I'm not happy to hear that, but otherwise I'm very happy to hear that. I think that's great news. All right. Today in the East, tomorrow in the West, those were the directions handed down by Ho Chi Minh in the fight against the French in Indochina. 20 years later, those same instructions were provided, I guess before 20 years later, but those same instructions were provided in the fight against the Americans and the South Vietnamese. And, you know, I read that a couple times and I thought, well, what did Ho Chi Minh mean by this? And I'm still trying to figure that out as I read through this book called Grasshoppers and Elephants. It's been a pretty good book so far. Today, I want to talk about some strategic factors that led to victory for the North Vietnamese. You know, you've probably heard before that the U.S. military never lost a tactical engagement with the North Vietnamese and any of these battles. But the North Vietnamese still were able to win the war. So obviously something there is not adding up, and we're going to talk about the strategic factors that led to their victory today, among other things. We will continue with our lessons learned on today's show. But first, I need to give a huge thanks in the shout out of the day to my new Patreon supporters. There are currently 94 of you supporting the show, so I certainly appreciate that. Thank you very much. I will continue to do the show and provide 30 minutes of my take on all things intelligence and security and how to win or at least not lose every day, Monday through Friday. If you want to support the show, if you want to support my mission, you can do that over at patreon.com/outfront. Kick me a few bucks a month and show your support. We're going to start off with Wayne, Daniel O, Andrew T, Kevin J, coming in hot with $25 a month support. Greatly appreciated, sir. We have Tux Prime, Doug, and we round off with Andrew Y and John M, each of whom are in for 10 bucks a month. If you want to support the show, again, you can do that, and I certainly would appreciate it. Patreon.com/outfront. And also, go ahead and hit me with your questions over there, because I would like to start answering questions, taking questions from Patreon supporters especially, so that I can prioritize my time for you. And I'll take my best crack at answering them. All right, let's cover something that may seem counterintuitive here. In low-intensity conflict, or people's war, as Mao and Giap called it, the political and social aspect is more important than the actual war fighting. As a matter of fact, you could say that much of the war fighting actually takes place on the political, social, and psychological levels. In order to win low-intensity conflict or a people's war, you have to do both. You have to be able to do traditional war fighting, whether that's conventional or unconventional, but you really have to excel at aspects of the unconventional and irregular warfare, specifically on the psychological side, the soft power side. That matters greatly, and as a matter of fact, I'll share with you a quote from Giap that really drives that point home. There have been numerous instances where the side that is militarily weaker can still win through superior soft power or superior political and social strength. And hard power is violence or coercion, and soft power is things like influence and propaganda, psychological warfare, information operations, things like that. We have repeatedly seen communists win in Southeast Asia using these strategies and tactics. And in fact, this is how the militarily inferior Mao beat the militarily superior Kuomintang under Chiang Kai-shek. And maybe we can dive into what happened there in future episodes. All right, this quote from Giap. He says, "The political activity is more important than the military activity in people's war." In this book, they mention it in some of Giap's writing. He talks about these political brigades, and he says they are, quote, "to become the eldest in a large family." What do we think he meant by that? Well, I think he meant that the propaganda brigades are of of more importance than the actual, you know, infantry warfighting brigades, because the propaganda brigades serve a very important role that the infantry and warfighters just cannot do. And that is building popular support and exploiting mistakes of the enemy and exercising all the soft power that ultimately leads to strategic victory. Because remember, low intensity conflicts are not won by violence at the tactical level. They're won through a combination of things, but probably the greatest being soft power at the strategic level. So if you do not have soft power, you're probably going to you're probably going to lose a low intensity conflict if you lack soft power. You cannot sustain hard power for very long without having soft power to back it up, because it's the soft power that allows you to continue using hard power, things like violence and coercion. That's why the left in this country has focused so heavily on building soft power, taking over institutions so that they can exercise soft power. And it's not just they're taking over institutions. They're using that soft power to dislocate institutions, or to dislocate right-wing control of institutions. We talked about this concept of grand strategy. And this is something that a number of people have talked about, but John Boyd is one of them. He said that grand strategy is connecting yourself to as many power centers as possible while disconnecting your opponent from as many power centers as possible. And we think about all the power centers in this country, and the left either exercises control or exercises a great amount of influence over most of these things. All right. So at any rate, back to this concept of the propaganda brigade being able to build soft power. Giap also says that, quote, it is the embryo of the Liberation Army. And why is that? Because you have to have popular support. You got to build popular support in these people's wars or low intensity conflict or insurgency, popular revolution, so on and so forth. All of the types, all the styles of war that fit underneath the low intensity conflict category. By the way, Inthos, I see your question and I will get to it later. Actually, Dustin, can we save that for later or something maybe? Thank you. I appreciate it. All right. Today we're going to talk about a couple of cases where the North Vietnamese or the Viet Cong were able to infiltrate into heavily defended areas of South Vietnam, specifically around Saigon. And they did this repeatedly all throughout both conflicts against the French and later against the United States and Indochina and Vietnam. And, or I should say, the French in Indochina and the United States and Vietnam. And we're going to talk about intelligence and the value of propaganda and popular support here. Infiltration obviously requires secrecy. That was stressed repeatedly by Ho Chi Minh, General or President Ho, and also Giap. And being able to infiltrate these Viet Cong fighters also required popular support. And there are these two cases that provide this. The first case was the 1968 Tet Offensive, which I saw several of you mention yesterday. No, there's no time to talk about it. But hundreds of thousands of Viet Cong infiltrated into South Vietnam during the Tet Offensive, and it was a major surprise. And you just ask yourself, how did hundreds of thousands of Viet Cong, and even if it was only tens of thousands, I don't know exactly how many it is. Allegedly, according to the Viet Cong, it was hundreds of thousands. I don't know. But even if it was just tens of thousands, there's mountainous jungles. By the way, mountainous jungles are like the absolute best terrain for an insurgency / guerrilla warfare. There's nothing that comes close. When you look at the win-loss rate of insurgents, according to terrain or, you know, their geography, mountainous jungles tops absolutely everything. So that's probably one strategic benefit that the North Vietnamese had, just being able to use these jungles and the jungle canopy and the mountains to hide themselves. However, let's talk about something else that happened. And this was in 1975 in the lead up to the surprise assault on Saigon. And there was a division of North Vietnamese, somewhere, I don't know, probably 10,000 troops, allegedly. Allegedly a division, but let's just call it 10,000 troops, somewhere around that ballpark. They snuck all the way around Saigon to within like something like 20 kilometers of Saigon. And this happened in the lead up to the assault. And they, they were tasked with taking this division, and they had tanks and artillery with them as well. By the way, there's some comments. I'll have to go through the comments later at the end of the show. So this division, they said, well, first of all, we got to push all the tanks and artillery back because we have to secure passage for them. Because when people start seeing, if the South Vietnamese ever see these tanks and artillery pieces come by, they're going to alert somebody. And this whole entire surprise assault on Saigon is going to be blown. And so what they did is they pushed all their tanks and artillery to the back, and then they crept through the jungles during the night. And during the day, they just laid up in the jungles where they were hidden. The problem is, as they got closer to Saigon, now they had to cross big open fields. And it's very difficult to do that. So that's what happened on roughly the last few days of getting in position here. These 10,000 fighters encountered this open field area, and they used grass and tree leaves and the foliage to hide themselves during the day, to cover themselves up. And according to this general who's in charge of this division, here's what he had to say. He said, quote, plenty of peasants saw us. They just winked or grinned and otherwise pretended that they hadn't seen us. There were no betrayals. And that's one thing I obviously take with a grain of salt. But I think even if that's not 100% all the time accurate, that probably was generally accurate. And this just underscores the importance of popular support, being surrounded by people who are supporting what you are doing, and how do you build popular support through propaganda. Now do we understand why Giap said the political efforts are more important than the military efforts, and the propaganda brigades were the eldest sibling of all the siblings in the Liberation Army? Because if they didn't propagandize, they would not have popular support. Without popular support, they would have been defeated. Everything starts, absolutely everything, I think, starts with propaganda or psychological operations or information operations. You cannot win a low intensity conflict without popular support. There's not a case on earth where that has happened. You just lose. You flat out lose. All right. Something I mentioned yesterday on this topic, let's bring this home. Something I mentioned yesterday is that I think it's going to be very difficult for the United States government to defeat an insurgency, a regional insurgency, or maybe somewhere that's confined to a city, or maybe a region of a state or so, maybe even a region of the country, where there's at least 10 to 25% of the populace who supports that insurgent movement. And this is not inconceivable. This is the point I really want to drive home. You know, there's a big focus on the 2024 elections. And I said yesterday, I think it's equally feasible that we could see some form of right-wing insurgency as it is that we see a left-wing insurgency following the 2024 elections, depending on what happens. Obviously, we have a failed or contested election, but I should say contested by, roughly a third of the country. There's a very good chance that we see political violence that might resemble a proto-insurgency or maybe even an active insurgency. And so, depending on how that election plays out, maybe it's not till 2028. I don't know. But there are some areas of this country that have 30, 40, maybe up to 50% of the people, of the populace, providing either passive or active support to, maybe it's a breakaway movement or secession movement. Maybe it's just a bunch of pissed off people who've tried to foment another popular revolution like we saw in 2020. Maybe it actually is an active insurgency where a group of people say, all right, we're going to establish our own government. The current government is illegitimate because the state legislature voted for, they didn't vote for the guy that the state elected or, whatever. You know how some of these state legislatures are maybe talking about not voting, not casting their electoral votes for the candidate that took the popular, all this stuff they're talking about. And so maybe you do have a group of people in this state. Maybe they even have political representation and they say, look, the current government voted in support of the other guy who lost this election, we believe, and we're going to stand up our own state government. I'm not saying that's the most likely course of action, but that is a possibility. It could happen. Or any any number of other scenarios. But my point is, there probably will be places where something like that might have 20 to 30+% of the populace supporting that movement. And at that point, this country is that will be a BFD. That will be a big freaking problem for the country. And so my conclusion yesterday was that, you know, this is concerning because it's not outside the realm of possibility that we see something like this happen sometime this decade, maybe not in 2024, maybe in 28, who knows. So one thing you need to be considering for your area study, one thing you need to be adding to your area study is political or social groups in your area who are actively pushing information operations or actively engaged in some kind of propaganda or any kind of information operations as we get closer to the election, especially if that election is disputed in some form or fashion. And all of a sudden we start seeing people, I don't know, putting up billboards or spray painting or protesting out with signs saying, whatever happened is illegitimate, whatever they're going to say. That is something that is going to be potentially very important for your area. And you absolutely should be looking for these political and social groups right now who might be engaging in that kind of behavior, because what they're doing, especially if they're on the far left and they know what they're doing is trying to propagandize and build popular support for the next logical progression here, which according to Giap and Mao would be terrorism or potentially organized political violence. And, you know, I say this and sometimes I think, gee, Mike, that sounds super extreme. But look, we got a couple hundred years of history now to back all this stuff up. This absolutely is the progression here. I guess I shouldn't say we have 100 solid years of we're just going back to the Russian Revolution here, the Bolsheviks. We have 100 years of definitive, authoritative evidence that this is the progression of events. And at the point that we see A happening, we can say, okay, well, B may not happen, but if we continue down this path, B will happen, and then C will happen, and so on and so forth. If we do see something like this, I'm going to go back to what Giap said, that political activity is more important than military activity. If we do see something like this, then you're going to have a very good picture. If you have done your homework, you're going to have a very good picture of the likelihood of success or failure based on the level of popular support for either side. If you live in an area where there's a great amount of support for candidate A and little support for candidate B, then you pretty much know who's going to end up winning this potential conflict, at least for your area. In either case, if this does happen, both sides are going to be competing for legitimacy and support from the people. Why? Because having support from the people means intelligence. It means supplies. It means medical care. It means communications. It means transportation. It means propaganda. It means all the things that happen. It means all having the people to fill the roles of the auxiliary and underground and complete all those tasks. And if they are doing it right, then both sides are going to try to turn people who are on the sidelines, turn those people into passive or active supporters of their political agenda. And we traditionally think of insurgency as being warfare. Clausewitz said that war is politics by their means. Insurgency fundamentally is a political conflict because it's the battle over political legitimacy. Most of an insurgency is not guns and bombs. Most of an insurgency is propaganda and what Bill Lind would call the mental and moral plane of conflict. That's where, you know, it's like an iceberg. Yeah, you get that 10%. Okay, that 10% is the violence that occurs. And then you got 90% of all these other things that happen in insurgencies and most other forms of low-intensity conflict where there is violence. This is exactly what you see. 90% of that stuff is non-violent. It's political, it's social, it's cultural, it's psychological, it's all sorts of things that are typically not violent. So if both sides are doing it right, they're trying to turn passive supporters into active supporters for themselves. And also, they're trying to deter support for the other side. That means turning active supporters or passive supporters into bystanders for the other side. It's not enough for you to win popular support on your side. You also have to actively deter popular support on the other side. And how do you do that? Typically through information, typically through propaganda or psychological operations. And this is why GIOP, who's this, forget being a few steps ahead. This guy's like a mile ahead of everybody else for two consecutive conflicts, both against the French and the United States. This is why he stressed propaganda matters. The propaganda brigades are the eldest siblings of this entire army. It's fundamentally what he said. Now, let's go back to this story about infiltration of Saigon because it is important. Again, this is 1975. Yesterday we talked about the evacuation of Saigon, and I'm sure all you've seen the very iconic picture of the top of the U.S. Embassy, and there's a helicopter up there, and people are climbing up the stairs trying to get on the top of the embassy to get taken away from through the helicopter, be evacuated as the North Vietnamese are descending on Saigon, taking the city over actually fairly quickly. All right. Back to the infiltration of Saigon. This is an interesting case study in the value of intelligence. One thing that this division did, this division that's trying to infiltrate into Saigon secretly, one thing that they did to bypass the defenses of Saigon, the South Vietnamese defenses, they allegedly had all the names of the South Vietnamese military officers who were manning or who were commanding at these checkpoints. And so the North Vietnamese division would take their field phones and go hook them up to the lines and say, you know, I don't know exactly what they said. Imagine it's like, hey, this message is for Lieutenant or Captain so-and-so. You know, this is Lieutenant so-and-so over here at, I don't know, checkpoint 68. And this whole area is, you know, this area, our sector is clear of any enemy activity or any indications of enemy activity. Okay, great. That area is secure. Everyone chill out. They don't see anything over there. And once they did that, then they were able to move their, move this, you know, they broke the division down into battalions and brigades. And then they're able to push their, the personnel through. And they're also able to bring their tanks and artillery with them because at the point that you put all those soldiers at ease, like, okay, there's nothing in this sector. Great. We don't have to keep an eye on it. Now you've got freedom of movement for that area. I thought that was pretty interesting. They gave the all clear as they were passing through. After they had secured passage through that area and they put these South Vietnamese checkpoints at ease, they would push their tanks and artillery through for this final assault on Saigon. Again, this is 1975, by the way. This is the exact same strategy and tactics that they used to infiltrate into Saigon back in 1968 during the Tet Offensive. Allegedly, again, I'll take part of this book with a grain of salt because much of this is like firsthand testimony from North Vietnamese Army and Viet Cong fighters. And it's obviously written by a guy who's pro-communist anyway. He's an Australian journalist named Wilfred Burchett. One important point that I think is interesting they make here is that in 1968, they said that a lot of them got lost during the Tet Offensive because they did not know South Vietnam that well. They didn't know the area around Saigon that well. And so by the time 1975 rolled around, I don't know if they got maps or they were just doing so much infiltration in and out of the area, they became experts on the terrain. They knew exactly where they were. They also had local guides who knew the area very well and could take them over, you know, mountain passes or take them through the little, you know, cutout trails in the jungle to get where they were going. Also, I don't know if they did an area study or not, but you should be doing an area study. You should absolutely understand the physical terrain around your area. This matters for lots of reasons, especially for securing your community during an emergency where there might be criminals or other bad people running loose. All right, we're going to finish up with the two decisive factors. According to the Viet Cong, the two decisive factors that contributed to the victory of the North Vietnamese. Morale is number one. They had superior morale. The other decisive factor was the support of the people. According to this, here, I'll just read it to you. According to this general, quote, among the decisive factors in our favor was the high morale of our men and the heroic support of the local people. He continues, quote, we urged them to rise up and encircle enemy pillboxes, barracks, and other positions. By the way, that's, if you heard that, that's my dog moaning in the background because you got to stay inside for 15 minutes. To do their best to keep the puppets inside their positions and barracks while we weaved our way through. And they did this nobly. Once when our 3rd Regiment ran into some troubles, the people rose up and seized 4 enemy posts surrounding them. And this goes back to something that we talked about yesterday. Back during the assault on Saigon, Giap said, look, it's not enough to have a military assault. You have to go and foment unrest. There has to be people's uprisings in this area. And one thing they did was they occupied the runways. As the Americans and South Vietnamese leadership were trying to leave Saigon, the people just ran out and laid down or sat down or stood on the runways. So planes couldn't get in. The evacuating planes couldn't take off. And this just added to the layer of complexity of this military assault. It's not enough to have a military assault. You got to have active support of the people. And this is one of those things that made Giap like just a mile ahead of everyone else. All right. This will be my last point for the show. And then I'll answer a couple questions here. Do you remember what happened in Portland? Speaking of the importance of people and the support of the people, do you remember what happened in Portland back in the summer of 2020? When the Trump administration used, I don't know if it was like the federal marshals or BORTAC, or I think there were a couple other units there, primarily from DHS. They took some of these protest ringleaders, some of these protesters slash rioters slash political agitators. Let's be honest, they're political agitators in Portland. And they threw them into those minivans and they sped them off to jail. This was around the time they were trying to burn down the federal courthouse in Portland. And that made national news and everyone said, oh, this is fascism. Fascism's here. We have to go out and be anti-fascism. All right. We have to go do an anti-fascism. Then you have the moms of Portland. And you had, apparently, allegedly, the dads of Portland. I don't know if the moms of Portland actively supported the communist revolution that was trying to take place. Or I shouldn't say the communist revolution. The anarchist revolution that was trying to take place in Portland. I don't know if the moms did that. But the moms went out and they stood in between law enforcement and the rioters. And this is very important. They stood in between law enforcement and the rioters, so law enforcement could not go arrest the rioters. And it would not look good for law enforcement to go out there and, you know, arrest a mom or go, you know, push the mom down or go push the mom away to get to one of the rioters, right? This is use of the people. As soon as I saw that, I was like, these people are working just with a whole nother playbook. And I don't think the Trump administration, I don't think people in the Trump administration truly recognized or respected what was going on in Portland. Yeah, it's one thing to say, okay, yeah, these are radical anarchist revolutionaries and they're just being dipshits and causing trouble. That's part of it. That's not the whole thing. The whole thing, when you actually look at what was happening nationally all around the country, but specifically in the 120 or 150 days of rioting that happened in the Pacific Northwest, like Seattle and Portland, really. Portland especially, these people are using a revolutionary playbook that we have seen on numerous occasions. And you don't have to take my word for it. You can go to the websites and the Telegram channels and all the other places where they live, the Mastodon accounts and all these other things. And they are actively sharing PDFs of revolutionaries like Mao and Giap and other people and the Margarella and all, you know, a bunch of other people. So, you know, this is something that's 2020 wasn't a riot. 2020 was an attempted popular revolution. And I've tried to make that case repeatedly. I do believe that to be the case. And I've provided a lot of evidence also to back that up. All right. Let's get back to this. Oh, shoot. Dustin. Oh, here we go. All right. There's a question, by the way. Thank you for the $2 super chat. Resources for digital security and surveillance and counter surveillance. All right. So there's this dude named The Gruck, and he's on Twitter. He has got a, I think it's a Substack or some kind of blog or whatever. He used to have a, some other blog that I used to read a lot. He's a hacker and he studies hacker operation security. He'll go back through when someone get, when a hacker gets arrested or some terrorist or whatever gets arrested, he'll go back through and kind of study it. And he'll say, oh, here's how the feds got access to this, this encrypted chat or whatever. By the way, this whole thing with the Proud Boys, there's a couple of Proud Boys that have been arrested. Now they've been tried superseding indictments here. And apparently the FBI got a bunch of information from this quote unquote encrypted chat app. Listen, if there's like 50 people on your encrypted chat app, they need one account to be able to get all that chat history. If you don't have like auto deleting chat history or whatever, or, you know, if it, or if your encrypted chat app is leaving logs or, you know, taking, or even if there's an informant in there, just literally just screenshotting these things. Or, you know, probably there's some kind of software on there that's automatically logging all this stuff. It doesn't matter how encrypted that is. If you got 50 users on there, if you've got 5 users on there and one account gets compromised. All right. Sorry. Everyone disappears. So, I mean, everyone like, you know, gets arrested. And that's just not a Proud Boys thing. That's like a, like an everybody thing. All right. So I think the number one rule for digital security is keep it offline. I mean, let me rephrase this. Jesus. If you want to have good digital security, you should keep it offline. And I'm not condoning or encouraging anything illegal. I'm just saying in terms of digital security, if you are doing something that you don't want people, God, I don't even want to say that. I would say digital security, keep it offline. Actually, you know, there's a story. Ho Chi Minh, he stressed the importance of security to all his commanders, including GIOP. And this is going back even to the 1940s when they first started. He wrote down on a piece of cigarette paper, he stressed the importance of security. And I forget exactly what he said, but he stressed the importance of security, Ho Chi Minh to GIOP. And he took that slip of paper and he put it into a pack of cigarettes, which was then delivered to GIOP. Okay. So if there was the internet back in the 40s or even back in the 70s, I doubt any of these Vietnamese folks would be using the internet to transmit any kind of important information. I'll just say that much. All right. Any other, by the way, Inthos, I don't know if that answers your question, but oh yeah. So back to The Gruck. I asked The Gruck one day, this is like probably 10 years ago. I said, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, using best security practices, how secure is transmitting anything over the internet? Like, you know, it's encrypted, it's anonymous. You got layers of security. It's, you know, whatever X, Y, or Z. He said it's like a -1 on a scale of 1 to 10, not even a 0. It's a -1. So bottom line is, you know, if the FBI, if they're looking for you, they're going to get you. Or, you know, if you're some terrorist group abroad, if NSA wants you there and you're transmitting anything digitally, like they're eventually going to get you because your software has to be 100%, right? Your security mindset has to be on 100% of the time. And you make one mistake. I mean, there are things you can do to mitigate that risk, like compartmentalizing things and I don't know, whatever. There's a lot of stuff you can do. Typically, people don't do it well. That's why these people get caught, because they're just dumb. All right, Dustin, any other questions? Maybe we'll do a couple questions here. I don't know. I'm not going to answer that question. Thanks, John. Sorry, man. I'm not going to answer that question. That's a little too glowy, man. Put on my sunglasses. I know. I knew we were going to get all these glowy comments on here. All right. A little too much. All right. What with Russia doing way worse than expected, are we overestimating the PLA's capability? You know, this is something that I have been talking about. I mean, probably even back in like 2015, because as I recall, they were struggling mightily with their command and control. The Chinese PLA was. I don't know if that's still the case, but the bottom line is the Chinese are untested. I think China is a formidable threat. Every day that goes by, they become more formidable. I think the most dangerous thing from China right now is not actually their military, but their capacity for information operations and sabotage, and their capacity to cause a lot of trouble here domestically, which I think what's got to be part of the game plan. By the way, you know, I also think people tend to underestimate the U.S. ability to counter China. China gets 80% of their, first of all, they're almost wholly dependent on imports for lots of things, but they're highly dependent on importing food and fuel and raw materials. And they get 80% of their oil through the Malacca Straits. And could the United States shut down oil transportations from the Middle East through the Malacca Straits? Yes, this is why China's trying to build a pipeline, a land-based pipeline through countries with whom they are friendly, or, you know, allegedly friendly. All right. Maybe we'll do one other question. GIOP and Antifa exploit the left's collectivist mindset. How do we leverage the right's individualism mindset when organizing? Man, I'm going to say something that might get me kicked off of everywhere, but I actually think that Alexander Dugin has an interesting, I covered his book because I read it, last month or a couple months ago. When he says that it's actually hyper-individualism, the left is actually engaging in hyper-individualism, not collectivism. And he said that the right needs to collectivize, the nationalist right and the traditionalist right in all these countries. And one of the things he says is like, I don't necessarily want to like, necessarily like spread his message or proselytize for Duganism or whatever. But, you know, he talks about how he frames it this way. This is the fight against globalism, and that traditional societies, he calls China a traditional society. He calls the Islamic world a traditional conservative society. He calls, you know, Russia and parts of Eastern Europe as a traditional conservative society. He calls pro-Trump folks in America traditional conservative societies. And, you know, he says, look, this is actually the fight against globalism right here. And with intersectionality and, you know, all these various identity ways to express your identity, he says that's actually hyper-individualism, because it's not, okay, you're not just black or white. Now you're black or white, and then you're a female, a male, or X gender. And it's not just X gender. Now you can be, you know, pan, whatever. There's just all these different gender variations. And, oh, you know, there's just all these different ways to express your identity. And he calls it hyper-individualism. And I actually think that's a fair point. It's an interesting point. So at any rate, the best way we can do that is, I tell you, we have to just build our tribe. We have to build our tribe locally, protect our way of life. And, you know, if you want to make a difference, a strategic impact, you know, the thing that you can do is build a local tribe and get involved. I'm going to say it and people are going to roll their eyes, but honestly, get involved in politics, get involved in the school board, build a local political and social institutions that you can use to wield political, social, and economic power. I mean, that's the way forward. You know, you want to go, all these people say, oh, when are we going to do something? Just like that question. Oh, when are we going to take back the country? Man, the ship has sailed. You forget about taking back the country. Your mission right now should be building a first world zone in a third world country. Because if you don't build it, it's not getting built, and you will absolutely be inheriting a third world lifestyle over the next roughly generation, probably. That's my guess. And in some areas, you've already been third world-icated or whatever, you know, Californicated. All right, guys, that's got to do it for today's show because I got to run to a meeting. I will be back. Okay, I will be back on the show tomorrow, 2 p.m., we'll get started. We'll talk about some more stuff. I'll take your questions. If you're on Patreon, send me a question. It can be literally, I mean, almost about anything. Just give me a question to answer for you. Patreon.com/outfront. And with that, everyone be well. Until tomorrow, be well and stay out front.